What's going on, Micah?
What's going on, Derek? Glad to be on another episode of Freethinker Radio on KPFT. How you been?
I've been doing better. I was kind of sick.
Yeah, you've been under the weather.
Yeah, I've been sick all week, but I'm happy to be here for another episode of Freethinker Radio. And as usual, we're airing live across many different platforms on the Conscious Resistance, on Facebook, Freethinker Radio, Facebook. We're also on Float and DLive, and we're on YouTube once again. And then, of course, this will be airing on 90.1 KPFT in Houston, Freethinker Radio, as always, every Friday afternoon. So we are competing right now, Micah, with the competing, and I don't mean that like we care to, but we're competing with the selection debate. And the title for today's show, I figured it would be, you know, maybe relevant. I chose the title, "The Selection is Almost Here."
It is
on YouTube, but once again, and then
that's where we're at now. We're getting close to the selection, and right now, probably on some other channel somewhere else, these two buffoons are debating and yelling and talking about things of how to run your life. And just for those who might not be aware, those two buffoons, for those who are voting, aren't the only two people running. In fact, Mike, I think I heard the other day there's actually 21 candidates who are running for President of the United States, and for a range of parties, and not just 21 random people, but 21 people who are on the ballot in different places. I know the Libertarian Party is probably the only party that's on all 50 states' ballots, in addition to Trump and Biden. I said their names.
Yeah,
I feel filthy.
It's like profanity. You know, we're allowed not to say certain words on the radio, but those somehow get slipped through every once in a while. Trump and Biden, good God. Like you said, you know, it's almost an embarrassment. I mean, really, if you think about it, like to think that in any sort of way these people like represent.
They definitely don't represent me. And I hope that the people who are hearing this, because I know that most of our audience, you know, on the internet is kind of the same mind or similar mind, as, you know, obviously we don't all agree on every topic, but they're generally not out there cheering for Trump or Biden either. But I hope that our radio audience, when they hear this, that, you know, they think about that, like what you just said, is just there's a lot of people who do not feel represented by this whole system at all, let alone maybe they don't even feel it's a legitimate system, or maybe just not something they want to support. And it's important to think about that, because not to start us off on too many, you know, tangents before we get into the news, because we got a lot to cover. But I personally think that there should be an adult conversation about the fact that in a democracy, which is what we're constantly told that we should be striving for, there are always people who are kind of screwed over and who are forced to go along with the will of the majority, whether that means deal with a Biden or a Trump, you know?
You know, I think it has a lot to do with controlling the voice and those that can reach the masses, because, you know, a while back, a long time ago, there was a guy, and you may or may not like him, but he got a lot of attention, ran for president, named Ross Perot. And back then they had a thing called the League of Women Voters, and that was who controlled, who got into the television, the televised debates. They were the hosts, and they were a nonpartisan group. Well, I guess that was so much of a ruckus and so disheartening to the McDonald's and Burger King of political parties that they said, well, no longer will we let it be hosted by them. We'll form a committee made up by, you know, the two political parties, and they'll decide who gets in the debates. And ever since then, look who's been in the debates. Gee whiz. So I think that's a big factor, because they control access in that way.
Yeah, they do. They control. And we're actually, I know that a number of the stories that you had me pull up, Micah, that we're getting into tonight have to do with finances. And so there's going to be, and some of these actually, I was going over the headlines. I hadn't heard anything about it. So that'll be cool to get into that. But let's start a little local. I know we got at least one local story. And then I did want to provide an update. Once again, our brief COVID update. I just have a couple of stories that I think most people are going to want to hear, because it relates to the vaccines, and we're all ready for the vaccines to come, right? And then we also have just a slight update on that controversial story that you're not supposed to hear about, related to one of the candidate's sons. So we're going to cover that and more, but let's get it first into this Houston story. What's the deal with this thing? You have it, Micah? I have it right here, but what's it about? TABC?
Yeah, no doubt. I imagine that there's things like this going on around the country. Turns out that the TABC, as you mentioned, the Texas Alcoholic and Beverage Commission, you know, we live in a free country, but these people decide who can sell beer, announced Tuesday that it suspended 5 bars in Texas, including 3 here in Houston, for violating COVID-19 health and safety protocols. You know, getting up in there, telling people how to be some more. Alamo Bar and Grill, the standard of Soul Billiards in Houston, received a 30-day suspension to their liquor licenses. So that's it. See, that's another way they can control behavior, you know. According to TABC, agents from the commission conducted 1,344 inspections in the last week. TABC has audited more than 20,000 licensed businesses since the beginning of May. In Harris County, restaurants can operate at 75% capacity. While bars are technically open, many loopholes from changes made to TABC rules in June allowed bars to reopen under restaurant status. However, social distancing must be observed and face coverings are still mandatory when not seated to eat or drink. So, it's that, you know, clamping down on people, pretending like it's opening up more and, you know, telling businesses and patrons how they need to be while they're there. So, you can take that as you want to take it. I think, you know, people need to be responsible, but I don't know that we need, you know, that decision made for us. But that's a whole different issue, and that's just the effect of it.
Michael, when are people going to question this, though? I mean, like, it's October now. It's almost November, you know, and this thing was like 2 weeks or whatever, and some, you know, the point is the numbers, like we talked about,
beat the curve.
The numbers are going down. Despite this, like, I'm seeing the rhetoric around the country of like, okay, there's, I don't know if you heard this, Michael, they're saying we're already in a third wave. I didn't know the second one came and went, but apparently we're in a third wave. But the numbers I've been seeing show that cases are definitely tending down all over the place, and yet things are still locked down. Bars are still getting suspended.
Has there been a massive change in the death rate?
Yeah, the death rate has dropped, and even the city of Houston, the mayor has admitted and acknowledged that the number has stayed steadily low. Like, it's not like we're, I don't know, it's just crazy, but people are still being, you know, we're still seeing those repercussions.
Speaking of the mayor, I saw that he was going to take some of that CARES Act money, and I don't want to misquote the amount, but I think it was around $4 million, and I don't have the article, but we're in the local before we go too far. He's going to take some of that CARES Act money, you know, some of that printed money, some of that stimulus money, and give it to the members of HPD for overtime. Seriously.
So I don't want to get into that. It's like he can't get the money to help out the firefighters and help out HPD or HF, whoever, you know, locally. So just there's that stimulus money. But I thought that was supposed to be going to COVID recovery. I guess they would argue, well, you know, because of COVID, financial downturn, we need help from the feds. Is that the argument
they want? I expect we'll see a lot more bad spending of that money.
Yeah, and then that's the problem, though, is that the public's scared, and they, as long as they get their little $1,200 check, they're not really that concerned. And I don't have the story pulled up now, but maybe in a little bit when we start getting into the finance stuff, we can talk about it, because I know in the last 2 weeks that both the IMF as well as the Fed, the Cleveland Fed, have started to talk about now about more about a digital currency and a digital wallet to help people receive the coming stimulus checks and what some people are calling universal basic income, things like that. The Cleveland Fed is calling it FedNow. They're centralized digital currency, not a true cryptocurrency, but a digital currency. So, yeah, lots more on the stimulus coming. I'm going to jump ahead to just give you a brief update, guys. I don't want to spend too much time on this Hunter Biden stuff because we talked about it on last week's episode. If you didn't watch last week's episode, you can find the archives at kpft.org. You can also find them on Spotify at Freethinker Radio. And those of you who are watching on YouTube who missed it last week because we were banned, you can go find it on Library, on BitChute, and elsewhere and get caught up. But we covered some of the Hunter Biden stuff. And mainly what we were focused on is how Twitter, Facebook, and so many different people are really just making such a strong effort to keep people from talking about and thinking about this story, including to the point of just trying to immediately say, this is Russian propaganda, you know, don't pay attention to it, and attacking any individual journalist or otherwise who talk about these stories. Because I've seen, look, I know that there's going to be some people who hear this and say it's just right-wing propaganda. I don't trust Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani was involved in the cover-up of 9/11 in a lot of ways, so he's no hero. A lot of people in the Trump era forget that, but I don't trust him or any of those people. But you have to be able to think, especially if you're trying to be a journalist or a journalistic outlet, that we have to consider the information, not just, oh, well, that came from this bad source, so therefore it's automatically fake. And that seems like what they're trying to do. I'm going to show on the screen a tweet from journalist Glenn Greenwald, and I'll read it out loud for our online listener or our KPFT listeners. But he said, I hope journalists realize if Biden wins and you report anything incriminating about his administration, even if you ask critical questions, you're going to get accused of spreading Russian disinformation and helping the Kremlin. That's the top toxic template being implemented right now. And I think that's true, and it's very dangerous. So it's not about like trying to be partisan here and, you know, like, oh, well, some people might hear this and think you're going to hurt the chances for Biden to beat Trump. That's the problem, is people are so worried and concerned about defeating Trump or playing these kind of these games that they are, and even some journalists, they're willing to ignore a story if they think it's going to be damaging to their candidate, because they keep looking back to 2016 and they're like, oh, there was this late announcement about Hillary Clinton's emails, and that started all these conspiracy theories, and, you know, that's Russian disinformation, and that's how she lost. So now there's this kind of fear that, well, if we do that again, then somehow, you know, it's not going to go our way. And it's just, it's garbage. Anything else you want to say on that, Mike? I just wanted to add that in, and then just the only other thing to say is that even the Washington Post themselves, which I do not really like, but they are mainstream. So for those of you who are just thinking this is right-wing rags, the Washington Post said, FBI says that it has nothing to add to remarks that were coming from one of the top intelligence officials who said that they had no evidence that this was Russian disinformation. This was on Monday. Fox Business Channel interviewed Director of National Intelligence John Ratcliffe. Again, some of you will say, oh, it's Fox, but this is the Director of National Intelligence, so for whatever weight you want to give that, John Ratcliffe said, quote, there is no intelligence that supports the idea that his laptop, Hunter Biden's laptop, and the emails are, quote, part of a Russian disinformation campaign. No intelligence that supports that. There is no intelligence that they have that supports that it's part of a Russian disinformation campaign. Could it later turn out to be so? Maybe. Is there a problem with Rudy Giuliani being involved? Probably so. Is their story weird? Yes, it is. But at this point, we have no evidence to back up those claims to say that it's Russia or to tell people they shouldn't look at it. But mainstream journalists are being accused of being right-wing shills or Trump supporters just for talking about this and for bringing it up and saying, hey, guys, you know, we need to think critically about this topic here and not just kind of dismiss it offhand. What do you think about that whole thing, Micah, now that we're more than a week into it, and I'm sure you've been seeing it all over the place and also been seeing people talk about why you shouldn't see it?
I think it has a lot to do with, like, that whole frenzied thing up, like a Lord of the Flies type thing, you know, where it's all frenzied up, you know. It's like Trump's so bad that if you speak out against the only hope of beating Trump, and, you know, that's how they got it phrased. So never mind about maybe one of those people who votes for one of those other, you know, 18 or 19 candidates for president or write someone in, you know, never mind their, you know, vote. This stuff has to be heated up to such a big deal that it's like this, you know, I just think it's like I said on the last episode, I think in some ways that it's just a little dog and pony show. But in other ways, if it's got like all this condemning evidence on Biden, you know, I'm amazed. They don't care that was for the Patriot Act. They don't care that he was for, you know, printing up the money. They don't care that he's, you know, complicit with drone bombing, the whole Obama administration thing. You know, they don't care about that stuff. But all of a sudden, this laptop that his son had is going to, you know, reveal to the American people that they need to stop loving him. I mean, what? Really, go vote for one of those other 18? I mean, I'm not trying to be too flip on it. What do I think about it? It's ridiculous. And I don't think that we're going to get to anything that, like, shows. I mean, come on. The guy already supports war, counterfeiting currency. And you know what I'm saying? Like,
I don't think it's going to make a difference in the end, right? Like, the people who are determined to support Biden against Trump are really what they're doing. Because, man, I posted this article from the Houston Chronicle last week, and it was based – there was the quote was, I would literally walk through glass and a wall of COVID to vote. This lady was like, I'm so desperate to vote against Trump, not for Biden, but against Trump. And it was literally the same thing on each side. The other people said, I'm just worried that if Biden wins, we're going to turn into, you know, Antifa, full-on communism, left-wing radical, whatever they think. And they were even like, I don't really like Trump, but this is, you know, so people aren't thinking passions in terms of high principles.
Passions, yeah, are high.
And people are just like, whatever I have to do to survive. And I think the system really thrives off that, keeping people in a survival mode of like, just whatever I got to do to keep things, you know, make me feel safe and make this go away.
If you get beyond survival mode, what happens? You reflect. You plan.
Yeah, you do it. You and the other thing, yesterday, Obama came out and campaigned for Biden for like the first time, right? And they were making a big deal. And I, you know, I gave it a minute to sort of see what he was talking about because CNN told me, oh my God, you can't miss this clip of Obama calling out Trump. And this is what he's telling people is, guess what? If you vote for Biden, you're going to look forward to a future where you don't have to be concerned that your president's out there tweeting conspiracy theories or that you don't have to be embarrassed by the things he says. You can finally put that aside. Not that like, hey, the wars are going to end or that, you know, we're going to fix the broken prison system or the police state. No, but you'll be able to rest a little bit easier at least because the guy in there, he won't be as loud and obnoxious. Now, that doesn't mean he's not going to do the exact same things, but at least you'll be able to rest because that guy won't be there. I mean, it's just, but in the background, people are, because of course, this was a socially distanced, safe rally within the car. You hear all these car horns. You know, but that's the best they got.
I see a number of people on the left, definitely more left than I am, saying things that I think might have, you know, a good amount of validity, especially to some of our listeners of, you know, when you're voting for Biden, you're voting for more of the same, you know, you're voting for a lot of the same policies like you're pointing out here. So I don't know. I'm hoping that people, you know, it seems like now more than ever, it's probably time for people to think about some other options. And I know, you know, we've spoken for years about taking, you know, control in your personal life and making, creating solutions as options for yourself. But, you know, if ever there was a time, I mean, just the fact that I feel like these two are so bad that I almost, you know, I just want to vote because I want to have seen that these two were so bad and I went and did something else. I honestly think as far as voting, you know, presidents, what Roosevelt say, they're selected, not elected. And, you know, that's so far away. It's probably farther away from, you know, your average American citizen than the King of England was back during the Revolution. But, you know, at the same time, I do think getting involved and going to like your neighborhood where they sit there and they talk about maybe the mayor candidates are being interviewed, things like that. You can get into things on a local level where we probably affect things more. And I think that part of the thing with having the presidential race so loud is to make all the sports mentality voters come out. You know, they don't even have an issue. They just are like, you know, they're all wrapped up in the passion of this team or that team to some degree. And maybe they think this team cares more, or that team is going to turn a socialist or this or that. I don't know. But, you know, in these general type terms, not in any like, oh, I know the history of the voting record. I've looked on, you know, Open Congress and looked and I have a principled stand here. I think that maybe that's one of the reasons that the presidential race is so loud, because then it helps sell souls, or whatever you want to say. It helps sell these policies, and you've got your, you know, you've got your fall guy every so often, and they're usually some kind of halfway ludicrous clown, at least for the last 50 years.
It keeps people going. And I just have one other point on the whole voting thing that you just made me think of, and I don't want to spend too much time, although this is an important topic to wax on. It's something we've gone over, but I know that the audience, and especially those on KPFT, might benefit from these thoughts. But I did have a friend reach out to me or comment on Facebook the other day, and she's a nice person that I've met over the last year. And she's also a lesbian woman. And she said like her reason for supporting Biden over Trump, even though she doesn't see major differences, is that, you know, he's going to, you know, remove health care, or that he, you know, in her view, he is attacking the LGBTQ community. And she was saying how, like, you know, he would probably try to overturn the Supreme Court decision that allowed me and my wife to get married, and there's benefits to that. And, you know, we got into a whole other discussion where I was like, I don't think the government should even be telling you who you should marry in the first place. You should be able to marry your wife regardless. You should, you know, that's a problem that I think you should take up with the state, instead of thinking like, well, let me vote for somebody who's going to make sure that stays in place. But, you know, maybe that's, you know, a whole fantasy thing based on my ideals about, you know, no government. But like, I see that some people say they have a real reason to vote, right? Some people are truly just, I'm voting against Biden, I'm voting against Trump. On the other side, I've heard people say, look, I'm a single voter, single issue voter. My issue is vaccines. Trump has said in a sort of roundabout, I don't think we'll mandate it. He said, I think we'll see. You know, he didn't say anything hard and like, you know, strong, like I'm going to stand up and protect people's liberties or anything like that. But he said enough for some people to favor him, because on the other side, Biden said he would push to get the states and the cities to try to, you know, mandate it similar to masks and things like that. So people have kind of staked out their positions, and they're like, well, this issue, he seems stronger, and that's my main concern. I'm going to ignore all those other areas that they're 95% the same and just hope that my one issue kind of keeps me protected, which to me, if you really think about it, is not saying anything wrong with it, but is more of a selfish position, because a lot of these people try to act like they care about the larger collective, but it's like, hey, you're thinking about your one single issue you care about and saying, well, this guy's good on that one issue. Screw the other people who are going to be affected by him in these other ways, or everybody who's being, you know, taken from through taxation to drop bombs. Because that's the thing. People need to, you mentioned that people aren't talking about Biden being one half of the administration that was the drone king. Obama became known as the drone king, but Biden was his VP, and Trump became the drone emperor because he took it to a whole nother level. Nobody's talking about that. I've been digging into that the last week. That's another big area that Trump supporters are blind to, that people who used to call out Obama, nobody really talks about the drone war anymore, but Trump has increased that. And so you have all these areas where they're on the same page, but people still stake out their little piece of the pie and say, well, I think he's going to protect me on this one area, so this is what I'm focusing on. And what do you think about that? Like, is that a good strategy long term, or, you know, is that just, again, that self-preservation instinct?
I think it's dangerous, and I liken it kind of to that saying you hear about, well, first they came for this person or that person. You know, it's the same thing here. First they came to take this money from the child to fund this evil thing, and then this, and nobody stood. And then eventually they came and took the one thing you thought you were getting from them. Thanks for your support all this time. Bump it. Psh, you know, and at the same time, I think it's just also shows how much it's about picking winners and losers and not really about defending any sort of set values, even in voting. You know, like as far as the social fabric of a republic or social fabric of a nation, you know, it doesn't seem like it's like that we're looking out for, you know, either the best interest of a principal or the best interest of our people. It seems like we're all looking out for like special interest or sick of what's going on so much that it's like, yeah, I'm going to use my vote and you're going to tell me I'm wasting it, but I'm going to feel like I actually had some sort of meaning in it. And I think that's a really sad state of affairs for, you know, for any nation. And maybe it's just inherent in the size of it and all the money and corruption or something. I don't know.
Yeah. All right, guys, we talked for a little while about the election and voting. I think we gave them enough of our attention. We're going to move on now to some important stories about COVID. And we did touch on vaccines there for a minute. And I know that's a big concern of a lot of people who are concerned about Operation Warp Speed and the speed. Obviously, that name doesn't bring out too much confidence when you're talking about vaccines. But also people generally who have concerns about vaccines, who are concerned about it being mandatory, or even if it's not mandatory, as we're going to talk about in just a second, there's more of these push for these COVID passes, common pass, immunity passports, where you won't be able to travel whether you know with or without it. So they might not force it into your arm, but you won't be able to do anything. And that brings me to this story where one of the companies who is developing a potential COVID-19 vaccine, AstraZeneca, had to put their trial in Brazil on hold this week after a volunteer died. They said on Wednesday, a volunteer in a clinical trial developed by AstraZeneca and Oxford University had died, but added the trial will continue. They said that they plan to keep testing, saying in a statement that after careful assessment, quote, there have been no concerns about safety of the clinical trial. Somebody dies and they say there's no concerns about safety of the trial. A source familiar with the matter told Reuters that the trial would have been suspended if the volunteer who had died received the COVID-19 vaccine, suggesting the person was part of a control group that was given a meningitis jab. So this is the thing. In these trials, rather than comparing the COVID vaccine to a true placebo, which would be like, say, saline or water, you know, sugar water, something totally innocuous, and seeing how that group versus the group that got the vaccine, they compare it. One group gets the COVID vaccine and the other group gets a meningitis vaccine. And apparently one of the volunteers that got the meningitis vaccine died. So, you know, and this is just what's being told. This is all, you know, Reuters says a source familiar with the matter, because AstraZeneca is not really providing too much information about it. But Brazilian university that was involved said, quote, everything is proceeding as expected without any record of a serious vaccine related complication involving any of the participating volunteers. And I'm just having trouble understanding how they're saying that when somebody died, a 28-year-old man from Rio de Janeiro died from, you know, geez, this is just insane. I'm just looking at this, Mike. I'm looking through this one. I'm going to show you one more, because as that is going on, here's another one. This week, the same company, AstraZeneca, is planning to resume their vaccine trial in the U.S. with the FDA. So they have one vaccine trial in Brazil, and a man dies, and then now they have another trial that they're going to resume in the U.S. And when I say resume, it's because they had previously stopped after somebody else was sick. And they put this trial on hold September 6th after a participant in the UK's trial fell ill with what was suspected to be a rare spinal inflammatory disease called transverse myelitis. The sources who were briefed on that matter but asked to remain anonymous said that they have been told the trial could resume later this week. It was unclear how the FDA would characterize the illness. So again, these are the vaccines that they're rushing forward at warp speed around the world, working with companies, AstraZeneca. So in the trial in the US, somebody gets injured and has spinal injury. In Brazil, their trial, somebody dies, not from the COVID vaccine, they say, but from the, you know, the placebo, which was really just another vaccine. And then at the same time, Micah, this is not the COVID vaccine, but this is a similar kind of situation. In South Korea, they've had 25 people die from the seasonal influenza vaccine. And they said that despite this, they are not going to stop the flu shots for this season, despite a number of doctors now calling to put a halt on the trials after 25 people have been killed. Health authorities say they found no direct links between the deaths and the vaccines. At least 22 of the dead people, include a 17-year-old boy, were part of this campaign to inoculate 19 million teenagers and senior citizens for free, the Korean Disease Control and Prevention Agency says. Quote, the number of deaths has increased, but our team shows low possibility that the deaths resulted from the shots. South Korea ordered a fifth more flu vaccines this year to ward off what it calls a twindemic on the prospect that people with the flu develop coronavirus complications. And Health Minister said, I understand and regret that people are concerned about the vaccine. We're looking into the causes, but we'll again thoroughly examine the entire process in which various government agencies are involved. And this vaccine came from GC Pharma, SK Bioscience, Korea Vaccine, just a lot of Korean companies, international big pharma companies as well. And it says the Korean Medical Association, an influential grouping of doctors, urged the government to halt all the vaccination programs for now to allay public concerns and to ensure that the vaccines are safe. Despite those calls, they are not planning to do so. And that is insane as well. And then at the same time, we also have this other one. I don't know if I told you this one, Micah, but according to at least one report, the COVID vaccine could give you HIV. I'm not lying. That is according to at least one report saying that if you take this COVID vaccine, that it, I'll read the details, but I don't want to butcher it. But basically it's saying that by taking one of the COVID vaccines, you could become more susceptible. So let me see here.
This stuff sounds pretty dangerous.
Yeah. What do you think about that? First of all, what do you think about that one? Just the first couple I read, the code, the
self. I think all of them are pretty intense. What's the death rate at just being, like, look at the death rate of being one of the test subjects. That's got to be worse than COVID in general. I don't know. This is really, you know, it's rough stuff. And I imagine that people get hurt in this sort of stuff. But I can't believe, like, 25 people die from getting the flu shot in Korea and the government's like still busy, you know, I think that's shocking.
But is it really? Is it really shocking? I mean, it's shocking. Yeah, it's shocking to hear, but I mean, obviously we don't know anything about how all these vaccines are going to work.
Yeah, I don't know how many people die from the flu shot each year anyway. Maybe that's a new question. How many people die from the flu shot each year? Seems out this year in North Korea, there's going to be quite a few dozen or something. But, you know, I mean, I think it's unnerving. And I think the fact that, you know, these stories, you know, look, we see how easy it is for stories to be, you know, kind of hushed a bit. And then we see, like, you know, we got to get into another story later on the maker of OxyContin and the opioid epidemic. I mean, I don't understand why people would think that the makers of these vaccines would have some, you know, great moral agenda just because they make a vaccine. They can be in it for other purposes to make money or God knows what else. You
know? Whoa. Sorry about that.
No, I think it's just kind of crazy and everybody's in such a hurry that, you know, it's rushed at best, you know?
Yeah. And I'm going to just cover a couple more while we're talking about it. I just want to give the details of the HIV one. I don't want to say the headline and not explain, but it says that researchers, and not just random researchers on the internet, but the Lancet Medical Journal just this Monday said that there could be a potential increase in infections as vaccines are rolled out to vulnerable populations around the world. because some of the COVID-19 vaccines contain a specific, what do they call the adenovirus 5 or AD5, a modified virus, which is a vector to transport some of HIV's genetic material into the body. And they say that, you know, this was a cautionary tale of what they saw with the HIV vaccine over a decade ago, or at least efforts to create one, and that it ended up giving more people HIV in the process. So this came from as well the National Institute of Health. They also recommended against the use of this AD5 vector in HIV vaccines. And of course, Fauci was involved in the HIV fight years ago. And like, this is a whole bigger topic that we don't have time to get into now. I'm sure there's lots of people who are wanting us to go a few different ways with this. But the point is that this is in the mainstream being reported. Again, the Lancet Medical Journal and some others have come up and said that, like, they're concerned that the AD5, which is being used in Johnson & Johnson vaccine and the AstraZeneca vaccine that we just were talking about, where somebody died in one of their trials, that this particular vector, AD5, could lead to people getting HIV. I mean, that's just, to me, that's even, like, okay, so why at that point do you not just stop? Like, why are they even going any further than that? I don't know, but... And then, yeah, so we had a couple of COVID vaccine stories. The other two I want to mention just real briefly, just so people are aware. I know a lot of people, I've noticed this online, Mike, I don't know if you have, where some people say like, oh, stupid Americans just don't know how to wear masks and don't know how to just lock down and do what's good for everybody. If people wouldn't be so selfish, of course it's Americans. But in fact, there are people protesting against lockdowns and restrictions all around the world. The one I'm looking at now was just reported in the last couple of days, and tear gas and water cannons were recently used on Czech citizens at a protest that they put together in Prague to protest government measures that are supposed to stem the coronavirus spread. And there was apparently some radical football fans that showed up and, you know, made things violent or whatever. I don't know how, you know, much truth that is, but the point is that there's protests going on there. I've seen lockdown protests every week in London, across Europe, and even some smaller ones happening in the US. But
I don't think that tear gas and water cannons are good for the lungs.
Yeah, that's the thing, is if you use tear gas on protesters, right, and that you're trying to fight a respiratory illness, might not be the best thing to face them. And the other thing is that just what really grinds my gears is the fact the hypocrisy between these different protests, right? Because another protest that took place this weekend, massive protests in some parts of the country, was the Women's March movement. It was back for like third or fourth year. And I didn't see any articles being about how the women were going to kill people for going out there. Some of them seemed to be wearing masks from the pictures and videos I saw, but they definitely weren't social distancing. They were tightly packed in together. And I don't really care. But my point is that the media sure does tell people when they go out there and protest against a lockdown or a mask or whatever it may be, or a vaccine, whether you agree with the issue or not, you have to admit that the media is completely biased in the way they report on these different events. And they portray one in one way, and then they portray the other like, oh, look at these great people out here protesting Donald Trump and, you know, whatever issues. So just a reminder, if the banks and the corporations and the corporate media are on your side, you're not a part of some resistance. You're part of a controlled opposition, I would say. And the last COVID thing, Micah, I mentioned earlier, the digital health passport. The one that seems to be catching wind is Common Pass. It's funded by the Rockefeller Foundation and the World Economic Forum, who both are involved in the promotion of this concept. We've been talking about the Great Reset. And I'm looking at a CNN article, and it says, can this app help save the travel industry? Global travel has ground to a near halt due to the coronavirus pandemic, but now Common Pass can save the day. So, I mean, it's the reason I bring this up is because it's happening. It's coming like very quickly now. I think just this week in the UK, they started actually testing them out in some of the airports. So these things are coming. People are going to make use of them. If you don't, you will be restricted. You might not be able to travel at all. I'm going to play us a quick clip from this report real quick.
The world is a patchwork of travel restrictions. Closed borders, quarantines, pre-travel testing requirements, all of which keep changing.
It's enough to put people off travel or... together, and that's damaging for the aviation sector, for tourism, for the whole global economy. However, one solution to travel could be a passport. Not this kind, but this, a digital health passport.
The app has been developed by the Commons Project Foundation in partnership with the World Economic Forum. The concept is simple enough. A traveler checks the app to see what the COVID-19 rules are at their destination. For example, it may require a PCR test 24 hours before travel. The app tells the traveler where they can get a government-approved COVID-19 test and uploads that test result to the app. If negative, the app generates a QR code confirming the traveler's compliance to be scanned by airline staff and border officials. However, testing prior to travel has its limitations.
That moment that person was safe to fly or migrate or whatever it is, because they were PCR negative, which is probably sort of, you know, meaningless if they were about to turn PCR positive 5 minutes after you did the test.
Common Pass says screening minimises the risk and is already a requirement for entry into many countries. A trial of their app is underway for volunteer passengers flying with United Airlines and Cathay Pacific between London, New York, Hong Kong and Singapore. If it goes well, Common Pass hopes more airlines and airports will use it in the future.
We've actually managed to convene over 50 countries that have come together through dialogue that led up to Common Pass, most of the world's biggest airlines, most of the world's biggest airports. And I think one of the realizations that they've come to through these discussions is this kind of system has to work in a globally interoperable way. It can't only work within one bubble or with one travel corridor.
If a COVID-19 vaccine is successfully developed, Common Pass hopes travelers will be able to log their vaccination into the app. Yes.
All right, we've probably played enough of that, but you guys get the point. We've been talking about this for months now, and here it is, Micah. It's starting to roll out.
Yeah, I think people aren't flying anyway. You know, maybe this is like just as much of an attempt to control people as an attempt to let them think that it's safe enough to fly. Like they.
Yeah, and I, you're right, though. People aren't flying. The airline industry is dying. And I've seen some people say, well, you know what? They're losing my money. They're never going to get my money again and all that. And I get that. But I feel like, you know, we shouldn't have to make that choice, right? Because it's not just that flying. Flying is the first place they roll it out, right? Just like with the TSA and the body scanners. But now those are at Super Bowl stadiums. Those are at, you know, lots of different places, the bus stations, train stations, subways. So how hard is it to imagine that your boss or somebody might start using an app like this and say, hey, we want everybody to get on that Common Pass app and just make sure, you know, you get your test and everything's up to date. And then when you come in, you scan it. And if it says you're good to go, then you can come into work. If not, then, you know, you'll have to come in after you quarantine or whatever. So to me, it's clear that this is going to be rolled out in other ways. This is just the beginning. And I mean, we got to support those, I guess, who don't want to implement these, because you can't really stop the rollout. I mean, the companies are there, the technology is there. Clearly people are going to embrace it, but yeah. All right, man, I'm going to shut up and pass it your way. We'll start off with some Goldman Sachs and some other Fed stuff.
People are going to embrace it, and it's kind of frustrating. But I don't know what to do about it. I mean, it's one thing to not be able to board an airline, but another thing if they actually, you know, restrict your personal travel, et cetera, for not having one. You know, I think we get into different, you know, it's hard to believe in this day and age, but maybe we even get into some legal difficulties. I'm not really sure where we are, what articles we wanted to get into next, Derek, because we have just so much stuff. And I thought maybe, you know, some of these things we should just hit quickly, like this thing from Mint Press where we're talking about the FCC head and Internet's most hated man, Ajit Pai, just vowed to kill First Amendment rights online. I mean,
I got that one pulled up. Go ahead and hit that one real quick.
Yeah, citing censorship outcry from the three branches of government, FCC chairman announced yesterday via tweet that the agency's intention, you know, this is a bureaucratic agency, you know, basically staffed by the, you know, executive branch's decisions. He tweeted out that this agency has intentions now, you know, never mind anything about just working for the executive branch and, you know, observing the Constitution. They have intentions to move forward with the regulation of social media by looking to modify Section 230 of the Communications Act, which protects the likes of Facebook and Twitter from the parts of the U.S. code that opens publishers to legal challenges over the content posted to their platforms, which inevitably puts content creators themselves in the crosshairs of the legal system without the benefit of their First Amendment rights. And he tweets out this whole explanation of it. And then, despite claims of bipartisan support for this reform initiative, one of the Section 230's original authors, Senator Wyden from Oregon, directly challenged the FCC chair's authority to change the law altogether. Pai, that's the FCC chair, claimed that the FCC lawyers have assured him the agency has legal standing to amend the law. Okay, I mean, I think that's kind of important right there. You've got a bureaucracy deciding what the law is and amending the law, changing the law. I think that's something important to consider. I don't know how often I've seen that. I mean, I know they do what they want, but this is a bold step forward in just printing it and putting it out there. Meanwhile, FCC Commissioner and Democratic Party member Jessica Rosenworcel denounced the FCC's timing as absurd and decried the chairman's decision to kowtow to Trump's executive order issued earlier this year, calling for the agency to reinterpret the law. And the article gets in there further, but I thought it was kind of, the FCC chair was, the current one was appointed by Barack Obama and later designated chairman of the agency by Trump. He is a former Verizon company lawyer and the most hated man on the internet, Ajit Pai.
Yeah, I've talked about him in my documentary on 5G, and I want to reiterate with that point you said there that the Commissioner Rosenworcel, who's a Democrat, she was basically, you know, talking down to Ajit Pai for following Trump's executive order. So again, this came from Trump, from an executive order, and there's a lot of people who look. We've been complaining about big tech censorship. We started the show talking about the Hunter Biden story and how they're censoring that. We just came back off a 2-week ban on YouTube. You know, I get it, but the answer is not to put the government in charge here. And as this article does a good job of kind of talking about how, like you said, that one line where it inevitably puts content creators in the crosshairs of the legal system without the benefit of First Amendment rights. So it's not going to lead to helping us. It's going to lead to them controlling it even more. So there really is no good answer other than, I think, to decentralize the internet and to decentralize a lot of these aspects, because as long as they can cut you off from these big platforms that everybody's using, and in that they can, it's not just that, Micah. I've had people this week, I've seen people, their accounts have been getting suspended on PayPal, on Twitter, MailChimp. Like, you know, this is a cross-platform thing that if you've been associated, like, oh, you're a QAnon person, or you're one of these conspiracy theorists, or you're talking about that story we can't talk about, you know, they're trying to cut off your legs from underneath you, or you can't even continue to do what you do. So putting the government in charge is not the answer, and definitely not a big, big tech, big Verizon shill like Ajit Pai to rewrite the law. Crazy stuff, man.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. That's a story well worth getting into, and it's one of these other sources out there, Mint Press News. So they've got a lot of other stuff. You may not agree with it all, but it's important to source diverse sources. I would like to go to this one from Highway 989 next, because I think it has to do with what we're talking about as far as censorship. And I don't know if people can draw what you will from it. It argues that Louisiana is suing Google, and it turns out that 10 states are suing Google. They're basically, along with the U.S. Department of Justice, filed a civil antitrust lawsuit to prevent Google from unlawfully maintaining monopolies through anti-competitive and exclusionary practices in the search and search advertising markets. Quote, Google has grown into a big tech monopoly, which has stifled competition. Without competition, we don't have capitalism. So I am proud to blah, 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 help this guy fight for America, whatever he says here. But another quote comes out in the news release, quote, as one of the wealthiest companies on the planet with a market value of over $1 trillion, Google is the monopoly gatekeeper to the internet for billions of users and countless advertisers worldwide. For years, Google has accounted for almost 90% of all search queries in the U.S. and has used anti-competitive tactics to maintain and extend its monopolies in search and search advertising. Complaint alleges that Google has unlawfully maintained monopolies, obviously, entering into exclusivity agreements that forbid pre-installation of any competing search service, entering into tying and other arrangements that force pre-installation of its search applications in prime locations on both mobile phones and other devices, make them undeletable regardless of consumer preference, entering into long-term agreements with Apple that require Google to be the default and de facto exclusive general search engine on Apple's popular Safari browser and other Apple search tools. So the list goes on. Other states involved, though, are Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Indiana, Mississippi, Missouri, Montana, South Carolina, and Texas. So, you know, figured that obviously has something to do with the censorship as well, just in terms of control.
And I think that this is a different point that is, to me, more appropriate. For one, it's a lawsuit, right? This isn't saying that the state's going to come out and try to change the law per se, like with the FCC, which I think is insane. The FCC is not supposed to be writing law or rewriting law, but they are right. Google has been able to maintain a monopoly, just like Microsoft was sued 20 years ago for maintaining a monopoly. And I don't know that monopoly really, you know, they're still out there.
Charges making their product
exactly
unbeatable and the boot product.
It's the same thing that, like you just said, that Microsoft was being accused of. So that to me makes more sense than opposed to like, hey, let's get the government involved in regulating the internet. How about, you know, if the states are going to sue or whoever's going to sue class action lawsuits and try to break them up, then that could be more productive it'll be interesting to say the least, right? Because we do know for sure that the intelligence agencies, U.S. intelligence agencies, are deeply connected to Google and to Facebook from the beginning, all the way from the seed money from the CIA's venture firm, NQTEL. So, you know, how does that play out? What does that mean, you know, with separating and breaking up a monopoly that is basically big tech and government in one thing? I guess we'll see what happens.
20% of the states, so that's kind of interesting. Maybe it'll gather ground. I don't know. We've seen some of these things build. I don't know. Maybe people are tired of it. Also, that, like it said, more than a decade, they've had like, you know, that's generational now. They've had generational implant, basically. But yeah, I'm not sure what's next or best to go to, but I did think it's important. Maybe we go to this National Review one, remind people that, you know, they're talking about ending Afghanistan. I think we've been talking about it for at least a year or more here, you know, one of America's longest wars. And what was the point? I'm so confused. But it turns out that
9/11?
Something. Good God. I don't remember. I think it was pipelines and opium. I'm not sure, but I think someone told me that in a Burger King. $19 billion in U.S. taxpayer money was lost. I mean, this isn't even counting the money, you know, wasted in shells and bullets and death. $19 billion in U.S. taxpayer money lost to waste, fraud, and abuse in Afghanistan, Watchdog Group gets into. I don't want to go too far, but it does turn out that they say this amount was basically lost in government-funded projects in Afghanistan between 2009 and 2019, and this was Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. It's reported that the funds that have been wasted in the course of rebuilding war-torn Afghanistan, how to get war-torn? Government and military officials have repeatedly told the agency here that the U.S. military strategy in the country and the effort to turn Afghanistan into a, quote, modern nation was failing. And it just goes on. Congress has appropriated $134 billion since 2002. Towards reconstruction and nation building efforts, you know, because, you know, that's what we do here. That's one of the products, right? Of which they've managed to review only $63 billion. So less than half of it's been reviewed. And out of that half, the agency stated in its new report, of that amount, $19 billion, almost 30% of the half, of less than half, has gone to waste.
I think it's 100% waste.
Yeah, I do too. So they basically say that most of it, 33.4, went just from January 2018 through December 2019. And I agree with you. And it says almost half the sum was spent on anti-narcotics operations, while various U.S.-supported reconstruction efforts were also found lacking. So, I mean, you can get into this story more if you want to, but yeah.
You're talking about guarding the poppy fields when they say anti-narcotic efforts. That's what they mean. Guarding the poppy fields.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's a sad truth. That's what they're out there doing not all they're doing. Unfortunately, they're blowing things up and killing people and torturing people and kidnapping them from their homes. But they were also guarding poppy fields. And, you know, that's for anybody who's never gone down that rabbit hole. That's, you know, and that kind of leads us to the next story, Mike, I think, in some ways, because the past two decades of the Afghanistan, you know, story out there and the U.S. guarding poppy fields has led to the largest increase in production of heroin in that time, which has also led to massive heroin overdoses in the United States, not just street heroin, which does come from the poppy, which could come theoretically come from places like Afghanistan, but also Big Pharma's kind of version of it, including very popular and dangerous Oxycontin. And I know we got an update on that whole thing, which I think is important because those criminals should be held accountable as well. I don't know if this is true justice, but it's something.
It's something. You know, it's something, and it does make the public know. And I don't know if it's true justice, or if there really can, you know, I think that's a difficult thing. And obviously we don't have time for it this episode, but it's good to aim for loosely, right? It turns out that Purdue Pharma has agreed to plead guilty. So think about what that must mean, right? You got them with all their lawyers willing to plead guilty for something, right? Maybe they're afraid of what else it would be, because what we talk about with the plea bargain, you know, this ain't, these aren't poor people that got to get home and take care of their kids. These are rich people, right? So if they're pleading, then that's probably because they worried about getting in more trouble. At least that's my opinion. I don't know about you, Derek. The plea is part of an $8 billion settlement concerning the pharmaceutical company's role in the rise of the opioid epidemic. The company is expected to plead guilty to one count of dual object conspiracy. What? What's that word? For defrauding the U.S. and violating the the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, and two counts of what? Conspiracy to violate the federal anti-kickback statute. The settlement includes more than $3.5 billion in criminal fines, $2 billion in criminal forfeiture, and a civil settlement of $2.8 billion. Purdue will admit it falsely represented an effective drug diversion program and reported misleading information to the FDA. They lied, officials said. It will also admit to violating anti-kickback laws that encourage doctors to get them scripts out. And that's basically the most of it. But it does get into some more stuff that I thought was interesting, because it talks about members of the company executives, also the Sackler family, its owners, and how this agreement doesn't release them from criminal liability. Although the family maintains the entire time that they acted lawfully. So we'll see what all happens with that.
And I'm glad you brought them up, Mike. I found real quick two articles because I wanted to say that name for people who didn't know, because look, there, it's not just, Purdue Pharma, some nameless, faceless mega corporation, which is kind of part of the story, but there's also this family, the Sackler family. And I'm pulling up an article from more than a year ago, family behind Purdue Pharma pushed opioid marketing. And this is in Massachusetts, where they were being, the attorney general over there was saying that they have been, you know, pushing, they're of course marketing their product, but they've been pushing it even harder in areas where they know that people are addicted to these products, because they're just kind, loving, caring people. And this one was just reported a day ago. In emails, the Sackler family fret over wealth and opioid business. Soon after Purdue Pharma affiliate pled guilty to misbranding its addictive opioid OxyContin in 2007, so this is not the first time they've been found guilty, the company's Sackler family owners fretted about possible threats to their wealth. In May 17, 2007, Jonathan Sackler, who has since passed away, emailed relatives and financial advisors, triggering an anxious discussion. And he told them that he said that an investment banker had once told his family that he's already rich and that the one thing you don't want to do is become poor. Sackler responded, "What do you think is going to go on in all these courtrooms right now? We're rich. For how long? Until which suits get through to the family?" So, you know, behind closed doors, these guys are worried. You know, this family is aware. And it says on Wednesday, Sackler family members associated with Purdue agreed, of course, like you said, Micah, pay a $225 million penalty. But they, you know, and they're saying that, you know, they have no direct responsibility. They're trying to stay in the dark and in the background where they would prefer to be. But you can look, if you look up the Sackler family, you'll find more information. People have done some good investigations on them and who they are. And unfortunately, it's just a family that is out there. They're profiting off the opioid epidemic.
Yeah, for sure. And there's a lot of crazy corruption, and a lot of people might not see. But I think the next thing to go to, and we don't have a lot of time left, is this one about Goldman. You know, government Sachs here, Goldman Sachs. I think that's Goldman Sachs to pay billions and takes millions from top executives. I thought there's a lot of analog between these two, except here what we've got is, you know, one of those revolving door type companies. sliding up in there. It turns out that Goldman Sachs is admitted it broke corruption laws. What? Corruption and conspiracy at the highest levels? Say it isn't so. It must not be so. Agreed to pay billions of dollars to global regulators and financial, that's billions, and financially punished its top executives, resolving one of the scandals in Wall Street history. Goldman took $174 million in compensation back from its executives and agreed to pay nearly $3 billion to officials in four countries to end a years-long investigation into the dealings with a Malaysian investment fund at the heart of a global bribery ring. So I just wanted to mention that, you know, we know Goldman Sachs has long been involved with the Treasury Department and other aspects of government.
And they were in the Trump administration. They're there in the Trump administration, the Obama administration, the Bush administration. You know, these bankers go back and forth between private industry, banking industry, and government constantly.
Yeah, for sure. This is kind of their little quote. Goldman Sachs today accepted responsibility for its role in a conspiracy to bribe high-ranking foreign officials to obtain lucrative underwriting and other businesses relating to 1MDB. So it also announcement requires Goldman Sachs to admit wrongdoing and pay nearly $3 billion. So we'll see what else is going on. There have been a lot of things going on with the banks lately, I tell you that much. I don't know that we have time. There's always more news than we can get into.
We probably got time for two more. I want to throw one real quick, just headline, Micah, in there. We'll see if it matters in the end. But this came out from nextgov.com. DHS biometrics proposal represents unacceptable escalation of government surveillance, five senators say. Five senators sent a letter urging the Department of Homeland Security to abandon a proposal to extend its biometrics program. This includes Ed Markey, Bernie Sanders, Ron Wyden, Elizabeth Warren, Jeff Merkley, sent a letter to DHS Secretary Chad Wolf urging the agency to abandon this. And they said, quote, expanding biometric data collection in this manner would chill legal immigration, be inconsistent with our privacy values, and pose disproportionate risks to individuals of color. The scope, sensitivity, and invasiveness of the proposed collection program would amount to an unacceptable escalation of government surveillance. Now, somebody did point out to me when I found this, like, hey, it's a convenient time for people who might be running for re-election soon to put this out there. And, you know, sending a letter is probably the least thing that you could do as a politician, but just be aware the DHS is out there trying to expand and escalate their biometrics program along the border. Because again, you can find Freethinker Radio on Spotify now. You can find us on the Pinecast app. You can find us at thehoustonfreethinkers.com. And of course, we always cross promote everything at theconsciousresistance.com.
But it's great to see all the comments and get all the engagement here. I do miss our phone calls on the FM side, but it's been a great show. We covered a lot of stuff. I miss Johnny a little bit, but it's going to be good. I look forward to next week, y'all. Have a good one.
We'll talk to you guys next week. This has been Freethinker Radio. Peace.